Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, a Pennsylvania man who has one of the largest collections of presidential memorabilia anywhere and also has some little-known facts about American presidents. But up front, it's President's Day, a holiday that was originally created to celebrate George Washington's birthday, but now it commemorates the histories of many or all of the U.S. presidents. Presidential history was made just this past weekend when former President Donald Trump was acquitted by the Senate after being impeached for the second time. The presidency probably got more attention in the last 4 years than at any other time in the nation's history. On today's President's Day program, we discuss good presidents, bad presidents, and those in between. Joining us, Dr. Matthew Pinsker, professor of history and Pahanka chair in American Civil War history at Dickinson College. Dr. Pinsker, my first question is about this weekend. I'm always curious as to what historians deem to be significant in American history. Being impeached for the second time, being acquitted for the second time, as Donald Trump was this weekend, where will that rank in the histories of the presidents?
Well, good morning, Scott. Thanks for having me. But you're asking me a tough question right out of the box, because historians look backward, not forward. You know, you want to have a political scientist on the show to talk about where this might lead us. I'm no more expert than you are in predicting the future, but I'll say this. Right now, I feel like, in particular, the Republican Party is at a crossroads. As a political historian, it's an open question, you know, whether or not the party is going to transform and become the party of Trump, or whether it's going to return to its moorings and become a conservative mainstream party that vies with the Democrats and the center left for control of American policy.
Okay, so looking back over the last 4 years, I said that the presidency probably got more attention than at any other time in the nation's history. Now, a lot of that has to do with the number of media outlets we have, but Donald Trump himself demanded and got attention over the last 4 years. Would you say that's an accurate statement, that no president has gotten the kind of attention that Donald Trump has over the last 4 years?
I don't know. That's a tough question for me to answer. You know, part of it has to do with the multiplicity of platforms. You know, the reason why we feel like Trump is in our heads all the time is because of social media. You know, there wasn't social media in the past, and so it's a different experience. But when we talked about the impact of CNN and talk radio and the 24/7 media cycle in the 1980s and 90s, and how it affected politics from the age of Reagan through Obama, we also talked about, you know, the increasing pulls and pushes on people's attention. So yes, Trump craved attention. He got it by tweeting and by bullying on social media. But I'm not sure whether the answer to your question is a simple yes, because it was a shallow kind of attention, you know, fleeting. And I think other presidents were able to hold American attention in a more sustained way by the way they communicated, whether it was Roosevelt's fireside chats or other presidents and their, you know, formal speeches, sometimes just the symbolic action of using the bully pulpit in the White House. They may have etched themselves deeper into the long-term American attention than Donald Trump did. And that's to be determined.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. I mean, you gave an example there of Franklin Roosevelt's fireside chats, but I'm thinking about other presidents, and most of them that I'm aware of have been modern with their ability to communicate. I think of Ronald Reagan. I think of John F. Kennedy. But what about presidents before that, before the age of mass media television? Were there presidents who were able to get the kind of attention of the nation that the country, I won't say fixated, but got a lot of attention from Americans in everyday life?
Look, Scott, it shouldn't surprise you, but anybody who gets himself elected president is a good communicator, knows the value of communication. Now, I admit some were better than others, but you can go all the way back to George Washington. This is a man who understood how to communicate messages to people both by his behavior and by his words. You know, I'll give you a couple of quick examples. He shows up at the Second Continental Congress, which was debating whether or not to declare independence from Britain and go to war. He shows up in his uniform from the French and Indian War. He takes a carriage ride across the Atlantic coast up to New York for his inauguration as president in 1789 as a way to, you know, raise morale and meet and show that he was accessible to the people. This is a man who understood the value of projecting a certain image. And from him through to other presidents, you could draw the same kind of conclusion. Look, another quick example of the sort of presidential mastery of communication. For most of the 19th century, from Thomas Jefferson through until the era of Woodrow Wilson, right on the eve of World War I, American presidents just sent their annual message, or what we now call the State of the Union message. They sent it as a printed speech, and it was read to the joint session of Congress by a clerk. You can imagine how boring that was.
Oh, yeah.
Pages upon pages read by a clerk. But Woodrow Wilson decided in his era that he wanted to capture attention. He was a former professor and a university president, and he knew how to hold a lectern. And he wanted to change that tradition. So he began delivering the annual message, the State of the Union, as a public address to the joint session of Congress. And ever since then, presidents have largely followed suit.
Our guest during this portion of the program is Dr. Matthew Pinsker. He's professor of history and Pahanka chair in American Civil War history at Dickinson College. On this President's Day, we're talking about the presidents. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Maybe there's a particular president you've always had a question about. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, I'm going to get away from the communications part in just a moment, but I am curious if you have an opinion on, you just talked about Washington, but is there a president who stands out as a communicator?
Scott, you know that my answer is Abraham Lincoln.
Well, I knew you were going to go there.
I'm a Lincoln scholar, but I don't think you need to be a Lincoln scholar to realize that Abraham Lincoln is far and away the greatest communicator in American history, let alone presidential history. And it's because he was an incredibly effective writer. I would argue he's one of the greatest writers in American history, just understood the power of words, thought carefully about them. He was self-taught. There was no real teacher or school that prepared him for this kind of mastery. But he read. He read newspapers. He read the Bible. He read Shakespeare. And he, you know, he had a habit of reading aloud. And so what I always recommend to my students is that they read their own work aloud, because what it offers you is a chance to hear the sound of your words and how they come together, the rhythm of your prose. And that's what made him such a powerful writer. And frankly, you know, people overestimate how important some of his speeches were to the outcome of the Civil War. But what makes them so significant over time is they communicate a sense of values to other generations of Americans. When he was president, it was a combination of his decisions and other people's sacrifices and his words that helped, you know, define Union success. But in the years since, you know, we have taken for granted the Union victories on the battlefield, but we still remember and feel inspired by his words at places like Gettysburg. And that's what we were talking about a few minutes ago when I suggested that, you know, the tweets of the last 4 years are never going to last. But the Gettysburg Address, which, by the way, was, you know, not much longer than an average tweet, it is going to last, you know, maybe not forever, but it's certainly lasting another couple of hundred years in American public memory, as long as the nation exists.
I have never heard that before, that Lincoln used to read what he wrote out loud. And what it reminded me of, and just a few years ago, I think it was probably the 150th anniversary the Battle of Gettysburg and the Gettysburg Address, is that today, when many people recite the Gettysburg Address, when the part comes to for the people, by the people, that many people today put the emphasis on for the people, by the people, and that read a column that said that Lincoln probably put the emphasis on for the people, by the people. Would you agree with that?
You know, it's a tough question for me to answer. I always stick to the sources, and the sources for the Gettysburg Address are all over the place. It's almost comical to read newspaper accounts of the speech, and you're astounded by how they botch the transcript of the address. Even the shorthand reporter for the Associated Press gets some of the words wrong, the order wrong. So there are a few recollected accounts of how Lincoln emphasized certain words or what he sounded like. And I'm a little skeptical, you know. I hate to sound like the worst kind of scholar squirrel, but those stories like the one you just shared, I'm not quite convinced that we can put too much emphasis there on those details, especially when they're recollected to us after the fact. One thing is clear, Lincoln did not intend the Gettysburg Address to be simply something that was heard by the audience at the cemetery. It was something he knew would be distributed over the newspapers in the North. It was something that he knew other Northerners might recite out loud the way he did. It was a reading speech that he had created. And that's often how he created most of his communications, whether they were public letters or speeches. They were designed to be read, not just heard.
You know, and I times that we've talked in the past, Dr. Pinsker, I remember we had the same conversation where we talked about the best presidents and the worst presidents. And you are one who doesn't list James Buchanan as the worst president. I remember you saying pretty adamantly that you thought that Andrew Johnson was the worst president in American history. So I'm going to ask, and this kind of ties into where we are today with the national reckoning on race over the past year. Why did Abraham Lincoln choose Andrew Johnson as his vice presidential running mate? I know it has to do with politics, but didn't he foresee Johnson, you know, that Johnson was a racist and that decisions, now Lincoln couldn't have foreseen that he would have died in office and Johnson would become president, but that if Johnson did become president, he wouldn't carry out what Lincoln wanted. Decisions made by Andrew Johnson have arguably could put us in many of the places we are today with when it comes to race. Why did Lincoln choose Johnson?
All right, it's a fair question. And you can certainly make the argument that the elevation of Johnson to the vice presidency was Lincoln's worst decision. Although you have to begin that with a caveat. It's not like Lincoln selected Johnson and forced him on the Republican Party. The way they did things then was different. And so what happened was the Republican delegates, then calling themselves the Union delegates, they had renamed their party. They were making a specific outreach to draw war Democrats into their movement. And they wanted to put a Democrat on the ticket as part of a fusion or a coalition between Republicans and Democrats who supported the Union. That's why they renamed themselves. That's why they dropped Hannibal Hamlin, the current vice president, in exchange for nominating Andrew Johnson. And he was, of course, from the South as well. So it was all part of a national ticket. But Lincoln made the decision not to stop the elevation of Johnson. It was a kind of a decision to do nothing. And if he would have intervened, he could have prevented Johnson's elevation, but he chose to let the delegates choose Johnson. So he deserves blame for Johnson's elevation. But, and I think we've talked about this before, it's really important for people to remember that despite all of Johnson's bad qualities, he had two really good qualities, or he made two really fine decisions during his Civil War career. The first, of course, was that he was a Southerner who rejected secession. He was loyal to the Union. You can't praise him enough for that. And second, He supported emancipation. He believed in the abolition of slavery. That's why Lincoln was willing to let him become vice president. Now, you know, you said he was a racist, but back then that's like saying he breathed. Most white politicians said and believed racist things by our standards. I'm convinced that Lincoln was, certainly by 1864, well past that kind of endemic near universal racism, you know, that he had come to the belief that the time was ripe for a push for equality. And he was beginning behind the scenes and increasingly in public to make that push for integration. And that's what's so tragic about his death, because Johnson didn't believe in any of that. He believed in ending slavery. He believed in saving the Union, but he was convinced that blacks were inferior and that integration and equality was an impossibility. But Lincoln was used to living in a culture that was full of racist ideas, beliefs. It wasn't just like a handful of Klan outliers. It wasn't just, you know, a handful of rioters. It was everywhere, the churches, the schools, the politics. And so what he was becoming convinced about was that even though it was everywhere, it was changing, that the contributions and sacrifices of black soldiers, that the realization that slaveholders had nearly destroyed the country, that people were ready to accept a new reality. And he probably considered Andrew Johnson to be a classic example of people who were ready for change. You know, Johnson had supported the Union. He had come around to support emancipation, and Lincoln was completely, you know, realistic or at least reasonable in expecting that a figure like Andrew Johnson might come around to believe in equality too. And then, of course, you know what happened. Lincoln was shot and Johnson proved to be, you know, the worst kind of hater as a president.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk, we're going to be talking about Governor Wolf's COVID-19 task force and if any changes could be made to improve the rollout of the vaccinations or the vaccine. That's coming up as part of one of the segments on tomorrow's program, so be sure to tune in. Our guest on this portion of today's President's Day program is Dr. Matthew Pinsker, who is Professor of History and Pahanka Chair in American Civil War History at Dickinson College. Fascinating conversation, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org on Twitter. We are at SmartTalk, WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Let's take a call from Mike in York. Mike, you're on the air.
Good morning. Good morning to both of you. I may ask an unfair question. I had a pleasure of studying with Fred Greenstein, who was a student of some of the presidents, and felt that Eisenhower was, in an understated way, a strong president. So I was going to ask Dr. Pinsker his opinion. And a fairer question, if you have time, is what did he think about how Lincoln was portrayed in the movie Lincoln?
Okay, thank you very much for your call, Mike. Let's start with Eisenhower, whose reputation has really improved. His ranking amongst the presidents has improved in recent years. Your thoughts on Dwight Eisenhower?
Well, Mike from York was referring to Fred Greenstein, this very famous presidential historian, this political scientist who argued that Eisenhower is an example of what he called the hidden hand president. And that's somebody who operates more behind the scenes than out in public. And in particular, in Eisenhower's case, he almost presented himself intentionally as a kind of genial, bumbling old man when he was president, because it allowed him more freedom to be sharper and tougher behind the scenes. It lowered people's expectations and allowed him to do more, sometimes more controversial things behind the scenes. And you know, that book about Eisenhower, and most historians now believe that it does capture one of Eisenhower's successful qualities as president. You know, it can't overstate how successful Eisenhower was as president. You know, look back to the 1960 election and you realize that John Kennedy won, the youngest elected president in American history, because he was arguing that Eisenhower just wasn't vigorous enough, that the 8 years of the Eisenhower administration was too stale, or was becoming stale, especially in the heat of the Cold War by the end of the 1950s. So I think, you know, there's certainly truth to the power of the hidden hand presidency, not just in looking at Eisenhower, but in looking at other presidents. But I, you know, I wouldn't want to overstate it. Eisenhower was a good president in many ways. He was a great general. He was a good American, but he was not one of our greatest presidents, in my opinion, as a historian. And in terms of the movie Lincoln, I love it as Hollywood, but don't confuse it with a textbook. The script writer and the producer, Steven Spielberg, the director, they rearrange the story. Of course, they invent all the dialogue in order to create, you know, the classic Hollywood narrative arc. I don't blame them for that. But sometimes when I talk to people about it, I have to remind them that it's not exactly the way things happened. Lincoln did free the slaves and they won the war, but everything else after that in the movie was all the romance of Hollywood.
Hidden hand presidents, besides Eisenhower, who are some others that you think maybe behind the scenes were a little more effective?
Well, the classic example from the 19th century was William McKinley. He presented himself in such a weak way that his critics said he had the backbone of an eclair. But behind the scenes, he was tough and manipulative, a pioneer, too. I mean, he's one of the ones who helped reshape presidential communication. You never think of him, but he had the first professional press secretary, George Cordeleau, and ran a real press operation out of the White House. He was a more commanding figure than you might realize from history books. Now, of course, in the present day, the question that we have to ask ourselves is that what Joe Biden is trying to do as president in his first, you know, few weeks and projecting ahead? Is he trying to be a kind of example of a hidden hand president, someone who offers a kind of soothing conciliatory tone in public, but then behind the scenes is working hard in sometimes partisan ways to achieve his agenda? That remains to be seen, but you would think that the hidden hand model is something that is at least in the back of his mind and in the minds of his aides.
Let's take another phone call. We have Michael from Cleona. Michael, you're on Smart Talk.
Hey, how are you doing?
Doing well.
My question is, I remember a few years ago, you had Ulysses Grant, considered very corrupt, one of, if not our worst president, and you had Woodrow Wilson, considered one of our greatest presidents. And it seems like we don't think quite the same way about them today. I was just curious his thoughts on that.
Thank you very much, Dr. Pinsker, and he's absolutely right. I don't know if Wilson was ever considered a great president, but they have swapped reputations.
Presidential reputations ebb and flow. It's certainly true that the times helped change what people think was important or wrong. Grant is in the middle of a kind of renaissance because of a series of new books and scholarship over the last 20 or 30 years. They don't usually characterize him as a hidden hand president, but they give him credit for things that 50 years ago people discounted. So, for example, his efforts to crush the Ku Klux Klan and other ways that he attempted to, you know, improve America's position in the world. The corruption in his administration, though, just to clarify, was more about the people around him than Grant himself. He was a man of integrity. It's just that he was surrounded by a motley crew in an era when almost everybody was engaged in some form of corruption in Washington. That's why we call it the Gilded Age. He didn't survive that period of time with his reputation entirely intact, but historians in recent years have given him more credit for standing apart from that and just being kind of tainted by association in it. Now, in terms of Wilson, Scott, I do think there was a period of time when he was ranked as one of the greatest presidents, middle 20th century, Wilsonian internationalism in the aftermath of World War II was at its height. People believed that he may have been too rigid and professorial, but that he had the right vision for America and the world. And then in the years since, conservatives have beat back some of his reputation by arguing that, you know, he was too much of a liberal progressive. And then, of course, on the left, some people are now fixated on his racism, his own prejudices and biases. And therefore, they have attacked his reputation on those fronts.
And that brings up a point. I mean, as you said, presidential reputations ebb and flow. And so do society and the culture's attitudes. When looking through the lens of today at a president, in or any person for that matter, in the past, is it a fair thing to do? I know that's a tough question.
Look, it's certainly a fair thing to do, but we always have to strive to do two things at the same time. So one is we have to decide what's important to us. And then we look back and we see how past figures lived up to or disappointed those ideals. But the other thing we have to do at the same time is be sophisticated and adult enough to realize they lived in a different time with different standards. And you have to be able to explain them in their own terms and judge them by their own standards and then compare it to ours. I mean, what I tell my students is, I'll teach you in the classroom about their day. And then when you go out to the cafeteria or hanging around your dorm room, you can judge them if you want by your values. But in the classroom, when we study them, we have to appreciate them in their times. And so there's two things you do at the same time when you evaluate a president. And that's the only way to be fair.
So wanted to talk about the greatest and the not so great. The trio of Washington, Lincoln, and Franklin Roosevelt are, you know, consistently ranked as the top three presidents, maybe in some different order. But besides those three, who are the greatest presidents in your mind?
I'll answer the question, Scott. I'll tell you, but you know, I'm not really committed to these answers. I like to think in terms more of important or unimportant, strong or weak.
Okay, that's fair.
Pivotal or not, but one president I've always admired outside of those three is Harry Truman. Harry Truman was a flawed individual, like everybody, but he was a really significant, important president, especially in shaping U.S. foreign relations.
And when you say in foreign relations, that is obviously when the Cold War began during the Truman administration.
Scott,
is that yeah?
Did that answer your question?
Yes. Did you lose me there for a second?
I did. Sorry.
Okay. Well, obviously what you're referring to when you're talking about foreign relations, that was the beginning of the Cold War. You're referring to mostly the United States and the Soviet Union or the communist bloc?
Right. You know, I think that era, that period between 1945 and 1960, that was a dangerous period in American history. And I give the presidents of that era, starting with Truman, credit for navigating through a difficult time without plunging the world into World War III. So it's the Cold War, the challenges, especially that the Soviet Union presented, but the policy of containment, the approach to the Cold War that Truman adopted, it had its trade-offs, but I believe ultimately it yielded what some historians call the long peace.
So then on the opposite end of the spectrum, maybe I won't refer to the presidents who were, maybe I'll just say that we won't call them the worst presidents or the bad presidents, but those who were not effective. Who would you put on that list?
Well, like everybody else in the past, you know, not counting recent incumbents, Buchanan, Johnson, and Harding are usually ranked near the bottom, mostly for corruption or ineffectiveness. I mean, what's wrong about Buchanan is not what he intended necessarily. It was more what he didn't accomplish. I mean, his ineffectiveness in staving off secession is what ruins him in most people's minds. There are other presidents, you know, who were weak in their approach to the office, who were dominated by Congress. Some presidents like William Henry Harrison only served briefly. They're in office for so little bit of time that they're relatively insignificant. You take a figure like Gerald Ford, you know, who's a decent man and who tried, but was just just overwhelmed by the crisis after Nixon's resignation and his decision to pardon him, and, you know, served for 2 years, but was a relatively insignificant president during a relatively depressing period of American history.
Quick question from a listener, Kristen asks, have you listened to the podcast 1864? If so, what do you think of the portrayals of Presidents Lincoln and Johnson in it? Are you familiar with that podcast?
I'll be honest, I am not familiar with it and haven't listened to it. I watched the CNN documentary last night on Lincoln. I had mixed emotions about that, you know. But overall, I think there's been a lot of good multimedia work on Lincoln done in the last couple of years. So I'll check out the podcast for sure.
I didn't get a chance to see the Lincoln documentary on CNN last night, but I was going to watch it on demand. What did you not like about it?
Well, I'll say what I liked about it first. They had a great cast of historians, you know, a wide range of people, which is interesting. But they also engaged in a little bit of Hollywood myth-making. They had reenactments that weren't very compelling to me. And then they tried to hype up some of the stories about his depression or conflicts over his views on race that were guilty of what I think you and I were just talking about, which is, you know, judging a figure by present day values without trying to be nuanced enough in characterizing them all just for the sake of ratings. So, you know, I had mixed emotions. Overall, it was a high quality production. I think it's worth watching, but I certainly don't take it as gospel.
One final question. I think it's a good one, so I'll try to squeeze this one in here. Wants to know, question is from a listener. How did the disclosure of the Pentagon Papers ultimately affect the viewpoint of historians regarding the presidencies of Eisenhower and perhaps even Harry Truman and their policies regarding France's fighting to maintain control of Vietnam and other of their former colonies in Southeast Asia? How important were the Pentagon Papers?
The phrase they used back then was credibility gap. And the revelations in the Pentagon Papers in the early 1970s reflected backward into how presidential administrations from Eisenhower through Johnson had lied at times, deceived the public about their intentions and the operations of their policy. And, you know, it's part of what has created this toxic culture in American politics today. It was the erosion of faith in the government's word that has led us in some ways to, you know, the place we're in now, where people can claim anything is true and attack everything as fake news, and where we're debating simple facts. And so it's a pivotal moment. It's a depressing moment. And, you know, it's something we're going to have to address moving forward if we're going to try to restore some stability to the political culture.
Yeah, but at the same time, even though, yes, Pentagon Papers, Watergate, that did create that toxic atmosphere, or a lot of Americans lost faith in the word of their government. I mean, wasn't that a good thing that Americans learned the truth?
Well, I didn't mean to say that the Pentagon Papers should have been suppressed. Look, accountability and learning the truth is important, but there's no doubt that the lying and the deception that preceded those revelations, it created a challenge for our political culture, who to believe. And we haven't quite resolved that yet. We've had presidents from both parties lie to the public over matters sometimes large and often small. And we have to figure out a way to elect people to office, you know, who will aspire to have more integrity, more moral courage, and will do something beyond just trying to get themselves reelected. We'll think about the long term. That's why, you know, a show like this is kind of important. It just reminds people of the long history that we cannot take for granted.
Dr. Matthew Pinsker, always have a good time talking to you. I know our audience learned a lot today. He's a professor of history and Pahanka Chair in American Civil War History at Dixon College. Dr. Pinsker, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Scott. Good to be here.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Our next guest has one of the largest presidential memorabilia collections in the country, maybe even the world. Larry Cook, who lives in Dallas Township near in northeastern Pennsylvania, has been collecting since he was a child and has amassed some fascinating pieces. And he also could talk about some little-known facts about presidents as well. Dr. Larry Cook, thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Scott. I appreciate you having me on this President's Day. Thank you.
All right, here's a question right off the bat before we get into your collection. Little known facts about presidents. What's a little known fact that our audience probably doesn't know on this President's Day that you think is fascinating that maybe they should know?
Well, I love the little known facts on all the presidents, and I really like to talk about some of the presidents that really don't get a lot of people talking about them. And one of my favorites to talk about is James Buchanan with a couple little known facts. If you look at renditions or photos, there's a few photos out there, actual photos of James Buchanan. But if you look at those or prints that depict him, you will notice that his head tilts significantly to the left. And people just always have assumed and still do in some cases that his posture is that way because of a condition called wry neck, which is a chronic stiffness of the muscles in the neck. But in his case, that was not the case. He was born with a rare eye disorder where he was nearsighted in one eye and farsighted in another. And then his anatomy was such that his left eye socket was actually positioned higher in the skull than his right eye socket. So he just developed that posture with his neck or with his head being tilted to the left, probably from infancy, just to accommodate for his eye condition and his anatomical anomaly. So I find that very fascinating that his, you know, posture is like that for a specific reason that most people don't know.
You know, it's hard to say, but unfortunately, with a condition like that today, he probably would have a hard time being elected because of television and photography and, you know, that people would look at his physical appearance and say, that is not an attractive person.
Oh, absolutely. You know, that's one of the things that intrigues me about the presidency is that so many, you know, little factors can make a difference whether a person gets elected or not. And certainly looks have a lot to do with it. That would have really, you know, it's shown a lot, as I mentioned, in photographs and renditions of Buchanan. But of course, in today's media circles with social media and standard media, yeah, it would have really been brought out a lot.
Well, when you're talking about appearance, Lincoln, I mean, people were brutal when they talked about Abraham Lincoln's appearance, his height, how gangly he was. I mean, again, someone that probably today they would have, you know, a lot of people would have just discounted him, unfortunately, because of appearance. But even in the 1860s, there were a lot of people say, how can we elect this guy? Look at the way he looks. And, you know, he was portrayed as someone who wasn't very bright, a backwoodsman who, you know, wasn't very sophisticated. You wonder whether Lincoln, who arguably was maybe the most intelligent and, as our last guest said, probably the best communicator, could have been even elected or made it onto the national stage today.
Oh, yeah. You're absolutely right. You know, we talked today about how politics are brutal and some of the things that are said about our leaders are really tough. But it was the same in Lincoln's day. And, you know, Lincoln came across with his witty comments with that by saying, you know, when he was called two-faced, if I had two faces, do you think I would use this one? Yeah. And, you know, so he even realized that people were brutal with him, with his looks.
Dr. Larry Cook is an author and historian who has one of the country's largest collections of presidential memorabilia. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. So, Dr. Cook, let's talk about your collection. How did you start collecting presidential memorabilia?
Well, I don't remember ever not being interested in the presidents. My first memory of the presidency, and I think is probably what may have triggered something in my brain to be interested in presidents, but was November 22nd, 1963. Of course, that's the day that Kennedy was assassinated. And I was only 3 years old, but I do remember that day. I do remember my parents' reactions to that day. I remember them being upset. And I couldn't tell you anything the day before that or the day after that, but I do remember that day. And I think that may have triggered something in my brain. And after that, I was always interested in the presidency. And what really ramped it up was when I was about 12 years old, my grandmother gave me a Lincoln Kennedy penny that was attached to a hard stock paper piece that listed all the similarities between Kennedy and Lincoln. And many of us have heard, you know, many of those similarities. So, you know, Kennedy's secretary is named Lincoln, how they were both, you know, assassinated on a Friday sitting next to their wives, etc. And I was just really intrigued with that item when I got it as a child. And I went to the library. Back then you didn't have Google or the internet. So I went to the library at school and I looked up all of those facts to see if they were true. And then my grandmother and my parents were always very supportive of anything I was interested in. And so they would pick up, you know, other things for me, knowing that I was interested in the presidents, you know, campaign buttons, those types of things. And when I would get something that had a president's name on it, you know, a Nixon campaign button, something like that, I would go and look up all the facts I could look up about that president. And I started keeping notes even as a kid on the little known facts. I was, you know, I saw them even as a kid. I saw the presidents as people. People that were doing extraordinary things, but I also realized that they had lives and people around them and family and feelings and problems like all of us have and in everyday life. And so that's how I really started, and it just continued on, and it still continues on today. You know, yesterday I added three more pieces to my collection. So I add pieces to my collection every week, really.
What did you get yesterday?
Yesterday, I got a nice menu with Eleanor Roosevelt's picture on it that from an appearance that she made in the Catskills in 1950. And I love things like that. You know, those are the types of things that they're not worth a ton of money, but they're remarkable because they're a piece of history and they've survived. You know, that was somebody's program and menu that they had at the dinner that she was a guest speaker at. And then I got a couple of printing blocks that depicted Thomas Jefferson and Monticello that were used probably for some newspaper at one time. I would say they probably date back to the early 1900s, but they were probably used for printing for an article at some point.
Okay, so you started, sounds small when you're talking about buttons and the Kennedy Lincoln penny. As you ramped up, what were some of the items that you were especially fond of or that you really felt good about being able to acquire?
Well, as you know, I have about 8,000 pieces of my collection. So I have, and I'm really, it sounds a little corny, I guess, but I'm really fond of every one of them. Some of my favorite things are things that were given to me by friends, family, or that have really historical significance, or things that, you know, like I said, that you're kind of surprised that they survived. But at the top of my list, one of my favorite items that I have is the inaugural program and inaugural luncheon gift that was given to President Mrs. Carter when they attended President Obama's 2013 inauguration. And my wife and I have been friends with President Mrs. Carter for several years, and they gave that to us for our collection. And shortly after they gave the inaugural program and the luncheon gift that they got, I had the opportunity to meet President Obama. And so I took the program with me, knowing that I was going to meet the president. And I asked President Obama to sign that the program for me, and he did. And President Carter, some months after that, had visited me at my home here. And I showed him that I had met President Obama in the meantime, and President Obama had signed it. And so President Carter signed it as well. So that means a lot to me, because it was given to me by my good friends, President and Mrs. Carter. And then it's just, the story is just great that I got to meet President Obama, you know, shortly after that.
That is something. Wow. Let's take a phone call from Paul in Potter County. Paul, you're on the air.
Hey, Dr. Cook. I'm a county commissioner, actually, up here in Potter County. We have one common interest in that we've visited Plains, Georgia, more than once, but I'm not an honorary citizen, so that must be pretty cool.
Yes, thank you. It is very cool. And my wife and I were made honorary citizens of Plains, Georgia, by the Carters and by the council there. And I'm very humbled by that. And I thank you for your comment.
I went down in 77 after the election, and there was, the tourism and the peanut tour and everything. And I just went back about 2 years ago, and it was just amazing to walk around and have all those memories come flooding back. And it's like I had to run of the place. But I didn't call to talk about Plains. I called to ask you a question, because
sure.
You're not only a collector but also a historian. I've campaigned in four elections up here now and kind of based it on substance. But my question to you is, do you have examples in your collection where six candidates who didn't necessarily go for the quick hit or the marketing or the pizzazz, but tried to campaign on substance, failed because of doing that, and succeeded because of doing that? Do you have any particular outstanding examples where a candidate kind of rose above the fray by focusing on issues and perhaps trying to appeal to a thoughtful voter?
Hey, Commissioner, that's a great question. Thank you very much for your call. We have about 2 minutes, Dr. Cook. Substance, candidates who won on substance and candidates who didn't.
Wow, that is a good question and a tough question. Early on, I think when you're talking about substance, early on the campaigns were front porch, speeches and that type of thing. Like kind of back in Lincoln's time, we were talking about Lincoln's looks, but his actual pharaoh type, a tin type picture was actually put out on campaign buttons and stuff. So, people could actually see, who he was. Campaigns are campaigns, and the candidate's not always responsible for every campaign item that comes out. So that's a really tough one to answer, actually.
We're almost out of time. I have about a minute or so left. Speaking of Lincoln, and we do talk a lot about Lincoln and Washington on President's Day. I understand you have an item that was signed by Abraham Lincoln. That is one of my dreams. One of my goals in life is to acquire an item that it was signed by Lincoln. Tell me about that.
Oh, yeah. The item that I have is very, in my opinion, very historically significant. It's a commission signed by Abraham Lincoln. I got it directly from the family that were descendants of the man that the commission was signed for. And there's some mysteries associated with this that I'm still trying to track down. The man that the commission was signed for is Captain John Hall. And he's from Washington County, Pennsylvania. And this commission promoted him to captain of commissary of subsistence during the Civil War. And it's just 6 months into Lincoln's presidency. And the mysteries associated with it are that in John Hall's obituary and in his he's listed in the notable citizens of Washington County, Pennsylvania. It lists him in there that he was actually a secretary to Lincoln for 6 months. And if so, he's an unknown secretary. And I've done some research on it and continue to do so. I've had the item for about 2 years now.
Hey, Dr. Cook, I'm going to have to interrupt. Can we have you back and talk some more?
Oh, I would absolutely love to.
All right, we will do that. Dr. Larry Cook, author and historian, thank you very much for being with us today. I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a good day.